What's your opinion? This is It's Debatable.
Hello, and welcome to It's Debatable on Campus FM 103.7, where every week students of international relations discuss contemporary international affairs. I am Alex Bencini. Our topic today deals with environmental security in today's politics. Our academic guest for today is Ms. Valentina Kassar, who is an assistant lecturer of foreign and security studies at the University of Malta. Ms. Kassar, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Alex.
Tackling the subject from its core, what role does environmental security play in international politics today?
A couple of weeks ago, you might remember when I was here to discuss cybersecurity with your colleagues, we began discussing the way the notion of security has evolved over the past few decades to incorporate elements other than traditional or military aspects of security. So not only has the reference actor of security evolved, that is, whose security are we speaking about, but we have also seen an evolution in what we consider to be the sources of threat, so to speak, to our own stability and way of life. So the security agenda today has therefore come to be heavily dominated by what we term soft security issues or non-traditional security concerns. And these include a host of issues ranging from health to finance, economics and energy, and not least amongst these is the environment.
Okay, but would you say that the environmental security is therefore a new issue?
Not really, because concerns with the security of our environment are certainly not new in international politics. With the setting up of the United Nations after the end of the Second World War, the international political agenda began to broaden to include issues related to the environment and sustainable development, as well as concerns regarding ozone depletion and climate change, for example. Mm-hmm. There's a collective approach towards security that had begun to underpin international politics was also applied to environmental issues. So by the 1970s, you had the United Nations Environmental Programme being established, and this was followed by numerous conventions on pollution and conservation issues. We also had the principle of common heritage of mankind being agreed to, and this was most notably with regards to the law of the sea, as a result of the initiative that had been taken by Malta's then permanent representative to the UN, Professor Arvid Pardo. Other milestones that pushed forward environmental security on the international agenda included the 1992 UN Conference on Environment and Development in Rio, which we often refer to as the Earth Summit, and we also had the 2002 World Summit on Sustainable Development in Johannesburg.
Okay, and what do you mean by the term environmental security?
I would say attention towards environmental security can be twofold. Whilst on the one hand we are concerned by the threats towards the environment and the degradation of our surroundings in themselves, so looking at the threat to the environment itself, we're also on the other hand concerned by the impact of environmental degradation on both human security as well as the security of communities and nation states as well. Okay. So any type of environmental change, be it a depletion of water resources or air pollution or climate change or marine pollution, to just name but a few, will have an impact on the communities that depend on these very resources. And this therefore links environmental security then to other security concerns that need to be addressed today, and these include food security, health, economic security and energy security, for example. In fact, one of the foremost studies on such impacts was the 2006-10 review on the economics of climate change. And this highlighted the long-term economic repercussions that would be wrought by climate change. And this report did serve as an impetus to international awareness towards the need to address climate change and the mobilization of both domestic and international communities. So we had a lot of action being taken afterwards at a domestic level, especially in the United Kingdom, within the EU, and even more so at an international level.
Right. And about these concerns, I mean, what's the best way to address them?
The impact of environmental change on other sectors doesn't only create instability within the day-to-day lives of individuals or particular sectors or particular communities or individual groups, but will ultimately be a source of instability for the insecurity of states as well as regions that they form part of, and in turn the international community as a whole. So there is a domino effect, I would say. Moreover, the range of issues that falls under the umbrella of environmental security is extremely vast and far-reaching, and these issues, although interlinked, have to be addressed both individually but also holistically as well, so it makes it extremely complex. So action is therefore required at a host of levels. The international political community, be it at a multilateral level or at a regional level, must be mobilized and integrated in order to safeguard environmental security concerns. The United Nations is one such example that I referred to a few moments ago. The European Union has also been instrumental in this regard. In the meantime, individual nation states and governments must also ensure that public administrations are acting and serving effectively in a sustainable manner, and that they are implementing the international conventions and obligations that have been reached at a regional or at a multilateral level. At the same time, individual members of society and private establishments must do their bit. We should also keep in mind the fact that progress has been made within civil society as well, both at a domestic level and at an international level, and this has been extremely priceless and instrumental in pushing the environmental agenda, the environmental political agenda.
Right, Ms. Kassar, I'd like to thank you for providing us with such a well-rounded introduction with regards to the topic of environmental security in today's politics, and we look forward to welcoming you again soon on It's Debatable.
Thank you.
Thank you. Our debate now continues with our students for today, Christine Kassar and Ronald Sultana, both of whom are second-year international relations students here at the University of Malta. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Ronald, beginning with you, the EU has made environmental concerns one of its most important agendas, and this plays an important role in global awareness with regards to the topic of climate change. How has this affected Malta's government on its own environmental issues?
Malta, being a member of the EU, has to be in line with EU politics, and therefore it has to give environmental issues utmost importance. Malta's tied with time, directives and regulations. The EU's directive on the operational hours of the Marsa power station is one example. This showed that the Maltese government lost a certain amount of sovereignty and had to abide to EU directives. However, the Maltese government took its own initiatives to address the environmental concerns, for instance the Pembroke Primary School, which became the first school not to have to pay electricity bills. Another government initiative is the Eco Gozo project that aims in improving the quality of life in Gozo by, for instance, reducing carbon emissions and improving the water quality. Having that its goal is to protect the environment, this can help promote foreign investment and tourism.
Chris, what is your position on the polluter pays principle, or the commonly known PPP, and how is it applied in Malta?
The polluter pays principle, which is being backed by the EU, uses measures of pollution taxation and subsidies to provide an incentive to companies and the public to pollute less. This gives the polluter a choice whether to pollute and pay for it, or else be more aware and pay less. Moreover, this principle provides a win-win situation, since it can promote the economy and the environment at the same time. In Malta, the PPP is applied since people are paying for their utility bills and increased taxations on car fuels, for instance. Moreover, the government provides incentives and subsidies for those who invest in solar and wind energy. Such measures encourage the Maltese citizens to be more financially aware and at the same time being protective of the environment. The EU's emphasis on this principle makes its members have to comply with these taxes.
Ronald, back to you now. I mean, the EU is being increasingly active at adopting new initiatives to manage emission reductions. One important EU initiative was the EU Emission Trading Scheme, launched by the European Climate Change Programme in the year 2000. What are Malta's targets through this scheme?
This emission scheme shows how innovative and aware the EU is about challenges posed by the climate change crisis. The EU Emission Trading Scheme aims at promoting the reduction of greenhouse gas emissions from industries in a cost-effective way. This scheme allows states to trade units of emissions with other European states. Malta's target is that by the year 2020, the non-emission trading scheme emissions are to be increased up to 5% when compared to the year 2005.
Chris, do you agree that such measures are financially beneficial for the country? Or do you think that government measures should be in line with EU directives to protect the environment? Or do you think that government measures to be in line with EU directives to protect the environment are an infringement on economic growth in Malta?
Although I agree that such measures are helpful to protect the environment, for sustainable development to be achieved, the economy has to be safeguarded as well, and therefore we have to look at other aspects. From one point of view, it is clear that certain taxes and charges can negatively affect the population, especially those who are in a lesser position to sustain themselves. The increase in fuel and utility prices also affected businesses that provide basic foods such as bread. In the end, it is the population that will have to face the increased prices in markets. Such taxes offer a burden to companies that may have to increase the retail prices of their products and services. This may lead to less sales and thus also the discharging of workers. Moreover, certain companies, especially the little industries, may not be able to support such taxes compared to bigger companies. This may render little industries to become less competitive. The public and companies are burdened with these taxes through higher electricity bills, the increase in fuel prices and registrations on old vehicle taxes. It is true that it is better if in Malta we had newer cars, but not everyone can afford to buy a new car. The government incentive of giving 2,000 euros to those who buy a new car and scrap their old one is not that helpful. However, one cannot deny that it is not that realistic to have this incentive increased. In fact, this is just a scheme that will be removed once 2,000 old cars have eliminated.
Ronald, do you think that the new public transport reform can contribute to a decrease in the use of private vehicles by the Maltese people?
One of the primary intentions of the public transport reform was to improve its quality and thus encouraging people to use more the public transport. It is clear that if more people use public transport rather than using their own private vehicles, vehicle emissions would be lessened. In the past, many argued that using public transport was not encouraging to use, lamenting of its quality. Today, with the Arriva, Malta is provided with new buses that are more emission-friendly. However, many people across the island are still not happy with the new service. Many lament their lack of punctuality. In turn, this encourages people not to use the Arriva and still prefer to use their own private vehicle. Despite this, many are optimistic about the future of Arriva, that it could ameliorate its shortcomings and increase its efficiency.
Unfortunately, we have to take a short break, but please stay tuned to Campus FM on 103.7 and enjoy the sounds of the Beach Boys. We'll be right back.
Aruba, Jamaica, ooh, I wanna take you. Bermuda, Bahama, come on, pretty mama. Key Largo, Montego, baby, why don't we go? Jamaica, take the Florida Keys. There's a place called Kokomo. That's where you wanna go to get away from it all. Bodies in the sand, tropical drink, magic in your hand. We'll be falling in love to the rhythm of a steel drum band down in Kokomo. Now if you wanna go and get away.
Today we're speaking with investigative journalist and author William Marsden about the politics of climate change.
Tell us about Fool's Rule inside the failed politics of climate change.
Well, Fool's Rule concentrates mostly on the politics that has been going on an international level around the world. I traveled to all of their meetings over the last 3 years. And what it tries to show is basically why it's been such a failure. What is actually happening at these meetings? You get 192 countries, all of which are bringing their own vested interests to the table. They're not really negotiating climate change, they're negotiating a trade agreement. So Canada, for instance, doesn't want to harm its oil sands. China wants to keep its growth at the highest level it can. India also, ditto all the emerging countries such as Brazil, South Africa, etc. The United States wants to keep its superpower status. They want to make sure that its economy continues to grow also. Ditto Europe. All of these things are brought to the table of a climate change agreement, but the trouble is that climate change doesn't care about your oil sands. It doesn't care about your need for jobs. It doesn't care whether the oil sands are ethical or not. And it doesn't care about Australia's need to sell coal. All it cares about is how many CO2s and other greenhouse gases are you putting up into the atmosphere. And when you put up so much or too much or a certain level of it, then it dictates to you how much you have to decrease in order to basically save your species. It demands a complete revolution, a social revolution, a political revolution, how we do politics, how we do geopolitics, our international politics, putting our personal interests aside as human beings and as nations, etc., to tackle this really vital problem. We're not doing any of that. We just want to continue with business as usual. Just like as individuals, we want to continue with our normal lives. Nobody wants to sacrifice anything.
Are you suggesting that the governments are corrupted, and if so, by what?
In parallel to the rise of concern over climate change, there has been an almost takeover of our democracy by the corporate world, which is desperate to protect its interests. I'm talking about big oil and gas, the pipeline companies, refinery companies, the utility companies, all of which are the engines of our industry and have been the engines of industry for the last 200 years. These companies have succeeded, particularly in the United States, but very much in Canada also, in getting their man into office and getting their views across. Climate change undeniably challenges the view, the worldview of the right wing, that everybody is an individual and should make his own life and should have the freedom to do just that. It challenges that. It says you can't do that anymore. So you have a very powerful reaction from the right wing in against any action to curb emissions or any action to even recognize that climate change, man-made climate change, exists. So that is a huge hurdle.
So you've mentioned a lot of countries that are doing very little, but what countries are doing the most towards climate change?
Well, I would say that Europe seems to be doing the most, but you can't take Europe as a block. There's particular countries in Europe that have been very intelligent about this. Germany is one of them. Germany has created a very exciting clean energy industry, which is now a $1 billion industry and employs tens of thousands of people in Germany. Denmark is the same. At the same time, they're growing their economy. So they have proved that you can actually expand your economy through clean energy.
Do you think we will make the necessary changes before it's too late?
Well, some people think it is already too late, but we have to ignore that. We have to think of future generations. If you took all the cars off the road of the world today, you're not going to change anything in the near term. You will change a great deal in the long term. The key thing here is instead of to argue about our different interests in the world, etc., is to every country has to sit down and chart out a path for itself. In every industrial sector, every city, every social sector, etc., to bring in all the experts of these fields, just like they do, you know, before the Second World War and during the Second World War, use all of that talent to try and chart and plan a clean energy future. That's where the energy has to be, and we're not doing that.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you for inviting me.
Welcome back to It's Debatable here on Campus FM 103.7. I'm joined in the studio with Christian Kassar and Ronald Sultana discussing the topic of environmental security issues. Chris, what measures is the Maltese government taking in order to decrease vehicle emissions in Malta?
The encouragement of shifting towards the use of electric vehicles is a good idea. In fact, the Maltese government is aiming to have 5,000 electric vehicles on Maltese roads by 2020. With the allocation of €400,000 to provide subsidies and schemes to those who invest in such vehicles. Apart from this recent scheme, the VRT was introduced a couple of years ago to bring more awareness to the public to keep their cars in good conditions and eliminate cars with high emissions. This test was quite criticized at its initial stages since rumors were that many cars were being passed without actually being assessed. However, this seems to be changed and the test is becoming even stricter. Therefore, we can see that efforts are being made to reduce vehicle emissions in Malta, and this can play an important role to improve the air we breathe.
Speaking of the quality of air that we breathe, in Malta the power stations have been subject to controversy. Ronald, what are your views on the Marsa power station in the sense of whether it should continue to operate or not?
The situation is quite complex. Clearly, the Marsa power station has been causing a lot of pollution, and those who live in Marsa and the areas that surround this locality have been negatively impacted. The Marsa power station has been subject to controversy for the past few years, including the black dust issue. According to an EU directive, the Marsa power station had 20,000 operational hours to use, up till the year 2015. However, these hours have been exceeded. ENA Malta argues that the power station in Marsa cannot be shut down until the interconnector with Sicily is finalized in the year 2013, since this power station provides 45% of the electricity supply of Malta. Many argue, however, that this power station should have long been closed. At the moment, this cannot happen since the cables with Sicily are not finalized. Moreover, the Delamara power station on its own cannot provide the energy supply for the Maltese islands. This made the Delamara extension become more necessary.
Another huge emission producer is created by waste problems. In the past years, we have seen the closing down of the Martup and the Ortine in Gozo. Today we have the WasteServe Malta Limited handling waste in Malta. Chris, to what extent are its methods helping to decrease emissions in Malta?
Regarding the waste methods and measures taken recently, surely they are helping the environment and decreasing emissions from when Malta closed down the Martup and Ortine landfills. Since 2003, the Martup dump site has not been accepting waste anymore, and instead, waste such as construction material is being used for the rehabilitation of quarries. This was done by the contract generated by the WasteServe Malta Limited. This organization is contributing a lot in the decreasing of heavy amount of wastes in our country. This follows some ambitious projects that are being held by WasteServe Malta. We are now separating waste in Sant'Antonin Waste Treatment Plant in Marsa Scala. This was needed to increase waste separation in our country and also leaving more space in landfills for other wastes like construction waste already mentioned. And this contributed to an improved environment and lifestyle due to better air quality. Another positive thing is that this recovered material is exported to be reused and recycled. The Sant'Antonio Waste Treatment Plant was materialized with the help of the European Union. Also, this organization is giving the ability to compost waste at homes too. A family can buy a bin from WasteServe organization and compost its organic wastes at home. Obviously, this is good for helping Malta with the EU emission quotas and developments, and also avoid the continuous growing landfill in Martup and Ortine in Gozo, which are not pleasant for tourist attraction for sure. And the most economic benefits we have here in Malta is coming from tourism. Itself, this organization is good for our country, but also it is even more beneficial because it is generating work and job opportunities for Maltese people. And by this, more families might be aware of the environmental situation, not to leave out the projects that are being organized in primary and secondary schools, and also in local councils, to widen the knowledge among the population.
Ronald, are there any conclusions you'd like to make on the topic?
The debate brought about the issue whether being protective of the environment can hinder economic growth, or actually promote economic growth. Malta is trying to make its contribution to improve air quality and reduce emissions. However, there are certain cases where it did not deliver and failed to be in line with EU regulations that resulted in fines that have to be paid by the Maltese taxpayers. This in turn could be causing increasing pressures on the local government, as it has to face measures that sometimes are perceived as harsh by the populations, such as the increasing of the utility bills and fuel. However, these measures can be looked at from a positive way, since many people nowadays try to be more energy and fuel efficient.
Christian, how about you? What are your conclusions on the topic?
Thanks to the EU membership, Malta has undertook a wide range of measures that aim at protecting the environment by controlling emissions. It is not said that without the EU, Malta would have not implied any regulations of its own, but one can feel that throughout the EU, Malta became more strict on these issues, and this can be seen in the handling of the Martab and Ortel landfills. Certainly, climate change is a global problem, and it is not sufficient that a group of countries takes controlling emissions measures while others don't. Although global awareness of what the climate change is all about, we still see that in various environment summits, there are lacks of agreements. I think that EU's measures are important since the way they are implied. Members try to abide them to avoid fines as much as possible, especially in the current financial crisis among various members in the EU. Thus, Malta is provided with an incentive to control its emissions.
Chris and Ronald, I'd like to thank you both for your contributions that you brought to the show today, and we look forward to welcoming you again on It's Debatable.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You have just had the pleasure of listening to another student-run episode of It's Debatable, produced by the Department of International Relations within the Faculty of Arts at the University of Malta. For more information, kindly visit mrsa.org.mt. Tune in next week, same time, same frequency.